Sam.
Doogie.
Football teams bemoaning a run of bad luck is a tale as old as time. It's just not bouncing for us. We've been so unlucky with injuries. We're getting no luck with referees. We've heard them all before. But does luck really even out? Who have been the luckiest and unluckiest sides in the Premier League so far this season? And how could luck impact what we will see over the remaining 27 matches? Today, we explore all.
You've got to ask yourself the question, do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
You lucky bastard.
Luck, that's it. All I need is a bit of luck.
They call you Lady Luck.
The land of luck.
This is where good luck is born.
I like it, 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 I like it. I like it, I like it.
I am from the future. And all of this goes horribly wrong.
It can't go on like this, can it?
It can.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Truth Podcast. I'm Doogie Critchley. I'm the host today. I'm joined, as ever, by Mr. Sam Tai. Sam, how are we doing?
Very well, mate. Very well. Excited for a Doogie host day.
Yeah, it's been a little while. I too am excited. I mean, what a week of international football. And on that note, we've got to introduce our overlord. I've actually copied Sam's intro there. Yeah, the great man that is Jack Collins, Ireland's favourite son. You must still be on cloud nine. And then Scotland last night, I bet you were all over it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think I'm Ireland's favourite son. I think that might be Troy at the moment. But, you know, we can share duties in so many ways. What a break. I love international football, right? Like, it's always been a thing that I've really kind of had a thing for. And I wonder if that comes from supporting a nation where it doesn't come easy qualifying for World Cups or European Championships. The kind of drama and the intrigue and the jeopardy of having these international breaks and the qualification process actually meaning something. But I mean, I don't think anyone can sit there and genuinely talk about this international break and not be falling in love with the stories, whether that be Troy Parrott in Ireland, whether that be Kenny McLean scoring from the halfway line for Scotland to seal it, whether that be Curaçao, whether that be all the chaos that went down in CONCACAF. It has been an incredible, incredible international break. And I am very, very pleased that it's been so.
Oh, I mean, it just has been epic. And yet here, the English media are focusing on whether Jude Bellingham is right for England. What? We're just missing the point, aren't we, Sam?
A bit. Yeah, a bit. I mean, I have enjoyed, yeah, as you know, as I often tell you, I don't load the Twitter app up anymore, or very rarely do I. But I did have a look, a little brief scout around yesterday and saw a big argument brewing between one of my favourite broadcasters, George Ellick, and Daily Mail correspondent Craig Hope, about whether or not Jude Bellingham should be a story. And arguing about whether it should be a story has become the new story. It's not about the story. It's about whether the story is a story. And then so we've got lost even further down the rabbit hole of forgetting to talk about football once again. And as Jack has so rightly pointed out, there have been so many heartwarming, glowing, positive stories over the last 3 or 4 days. I mean, I didn't watch England in this break. That's not where the stories were. And yeah, it's cool that we ended the qualification without conceding a goal. But again, I wasn't really that fussed about that. I was gasping at the TV at what was happening in the Scotland game. And Jack sent me a bunch of messages laughing at me because I'm famously not a big fan of Kenny McLean. I've never felt like he was a particularly good footballer and have not made that a particular secret. But he did just score from the halfway line to get his team to the World Cup. So I'll give him that one. Good job, Kenny. Although technically it was Kieran Tierney that obviously scored the winner.
Oh, that was phenomenal as well. And for Scott McTominay's goal to not be a footnote of the night, but to kind of not be given maybe the moment it deserved to be given, just on the kind of bedlam that happened at the end and the quality of goals at the end as well. Mm. What an 18 months Scott McTominay has had. Like, literally everything he is touching at the moment just turns to gold, and it's phenomenal to see. But let's get into this podcast. And Sam, it was you that was suggesting this topic because it's an area that you've written an article about in your work for ESPN. If people don't know, Sam started a new job in the summer writing for ESPN. And why was this something that you were interested in covering? I imagine across your last decade or so in football media, luck is something you've probably talked about a fair amount.
Yeah, lazy Sam Tai, just writing an article and then deciding to turn it into a podcast. Doesn't want to do two sets of work, does he? No, it's look, I think this is perfect because it's a topic that I find very interesting. I've done a lot of research into, I've written something about it, but the podcast medium gives you one, the opportunity to talk about it in much more depth, and two, roll those ideas around and speak to two other people about it and see what they think. And you, one of you two might turn around and say, Sam, everything you've done here is complete rubbish. Luck isn't a factor at all. What are you even doing? We'll see. We'll see what you think about it. But let's summarize it. So I have created what I'm calling informally a luck index, but it's not so scientific as to have a gigantic spreadsheet of pluses and minuses that I'm publishing for everybody. What it is a challenge to a couple of particular tropes that I don't really like in football. The first one is people say your luck evens out over the course of the season. And I don't really agree with that. I don't think that's true. And I think I've seen enough football to realize that that's not true. And he's left ESPN now, but Dale Johnson, he's gone to the BBC, has been writing about VAR for years. And he used to do basically a table of all the teams that have benefited or fallen foul of VAR decisions that were wrong. And by the end of the season, some teams legitimately were about 6 or 7 decisions up. So we know for a fact that in the VAR era, at least, luck does not technically even itself out over the course of a league season. Some clubs can come out of it looking really, really good. And of course, if one club has done that, that means another club has fallen foul of it by some degree. The other phrase or trope I wanted to challenge was, well, you play everyone twice. People use that phrase quite a lot to say, look, it's kind of an amendment of luck evens itself out. But I think we all know that if you were to play Manchester City this season and Erling Haaland wasn't in the team, it would be a vastly different game and a vastly different challenge to what it would be if he was there. So let's say he misses 5 games this season injured, which isn't inconceivable at some point. Those 5 teams that play them in that stretch have a much greater chance of beating Manchester City. That's quite big. I think that's quite important to realise. I think that's called context, which is what we're all about on this podcast. So I've decided to track it all. That's what I've designed. I'm such a sadomasochist. I've decided to track it all and see what comes out because I'm interested in it.
I mean, I think it's a very useful thing to do because I do agree with you. There are a lot of cliches and tropes that get passed around with luck. And on a sort of very basic level, it all evening out across an entire season, I couldn't agree with you more. It makes no logical sense that things that are like a VAR decision or injuries or whatever, that they're not 50-50 things that balance out. It's not a seesaw of events. They're just one-off instances. And sometimes you might get 10 bad decisions against you in a season and 3 bad injuries against sides you expect to pick up points or against your toughest opponent, lose momentum, etc. It's just random. It is so random. There is no logic to luck. But you did kind of break it down, Sam, into 3 main categories for this index or article that you're writing. What was the logic behind those 3 categories? Did you consider anything else as well?
So I chucked this around with my editor quite a lot, and this is where we landed after much discussion. And part of this is about trying to take as much subjectivity out of the process as possible. But understandably, when it gets to injuries, it's going to be somewhat subjective. But there are 3 points of attack here. So 3 things that I am tracking that I think are affecting teams here in terms of lucky or unlucky. The first one is I'm tracking confirmed, and I need to stress that, confirmed VAR errors or refereeing errors. So on a 10-day delay after every game week, a KMI panel, key match incidents panel, take a look at all the referee decisions and VAR decisions that were made and vote between the panel of 5, was it right or was it wrong? And off the back of that, we get confirmed mistakes. We get confirmed errors. There have been 6 confirmed errors this season, or there were at the time of writing. Only 6, which sounds low, but probably that thing you're thinking of right now, that incident, probably wasn't voted as a confirmed error. But I took the confirmed errors because, again, just trying to take some of that subjectivity out of it as much as possible. I'm perfectly willing to sit here and say that that penalty that Victor Gyökeres won against Nick Pope, I think I didn't agree with the reasoning that was given to me. I don't agree that that touch from Nick Pope makes it not a penalty. However, it was not ruled a mistake, so it is not in this thinking. It is not in this piece. You may think that Jurrien Timber's goal on the opening day against Manchester United at Old Trafford was a foul. It wasn't ruled an error, so it's not in this piece. So I've stuck to the six decisions that are absolutely definitely mistakes. That's the first one. The second one is new manager bounce. So I'm a big believer in the new manager bounce. And I think that if you are the team that has to play the first game against the new man, when all the players are motivated to try and impress the new guy, they've got a fresh wind, they've got new energy, I think you're the unlucky ones. I think you're the unfortunate ones in the schedule, and you've come across them at just the wrong time. If you'd played them 1 week earlier, you probably would have won. But now it's anyone's guess. So that's the second bit. And the third one is the injuries. So that's the really subjective bit, because you've got to draw the line somewhere. And I'm not just talking about a couple of injuries here. I decided to put a fairly high threshold in. I'm looking at multiple key players. So let's give an example. Well, if Erling Haaland's out, that's one for sure, because he scores 900% of their goals. But like, let's say Arsenal were lacking Saka and Odegaard. That's a big one for me. That's enough. That qualifies. Or if you're lacking all of your players in a certain position group, so you've run out of central midfielders, or you've run out of right backs, or all your centre backs are injured, that for me is another one. I'm looking at those scenarios, because that's the sort of thing that can actually cripple a team. So those are my three things. New manager bounce, serious injury problems to key players or position groups, and confirmed VAR errors. And I've been trying to track that every week. So I look at the 11s, I look at the decisions, I look at the injuries, and I make little notes in a spreadsheet if I think something has happened. And there's been 110 games this season, I guess. 10 games a week, 11 match weeks. Yeah. So I've got 27 marks in my spreadsheet. So that gives you an idea of how many games from the first third-ish of the season I think have been affected by something here.
That is a lot, to be fair. But no, when you've got such a spread of categories and rulings, I'm almost not surprised. I don't mean to already have a go at the index. I think the index is great. But I do think injuries and confirmed VAR errors, in my mind at least, and I'll be interested to hear Jack's thoughts on this, potentially just right now as well, feel like bigger factors than new manager bounce for me, just because I think whilst motivation clearly goes up when a new manager arrives, there's also a lot of new tactical ideas to take in. It's not a guarantee, I think, of necessarily a vastly improved performance. I don't know whether Jack agrees with that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this, and I've really, really enjoyed this article, mostly because it helps explain why Fulham have been so bad. But we'll get to that. But I do think maybe Doogie's point stands a little bit here. Not necessarily in terms of that new manager bounce shouldn't be a thing. And obviously, when you actually dig into this in the article, Sam, some of them you're like, well, this new manager didn't have an effect. And thus, therefore, you can't take advantage of this situation. And I think that like it's another one where context should probably be key, right? Like Forrest appointing Sean Dyche ahead of their game against Bournemouth, you know, should give them a lift. But also, if you actually think about it, he came in, he had one day, I think, before the game against Porto, and then one day between them to get on the training field. So almost you'd look at that as a shift of manager and a negative, which you have done. Mm. But also, you maybe point in terms of if you're using new manager bounce, I'd be intrigued as to whether later on in the season, and maybe this is only something that could be applied in hindsight as opposed to something you could kind of do as a rolling scale. But if you look at all of the teams that played Forest in the period under Ange Postecoglou, or all of the teams that played West Ham United in that period under Graham Potter, where they, you know, they just couldn't find their feet whatsoever, would that be as much of a contextual bit as perhaps a new manager coming in and making an immediate impact?
Yeah, absolutely. This is another one of the things that I threw around with my editor. I said, is there scope here to go back retrospectively and start adding marks? Because like my example that I threw to him was, so at the time it was like 4 or 5 weeks in and Xavi Simons hadn't really played for Tottenham yet. And I turned around to him and I said, let's just use Xavi Simons as an example. It's ironic that I'm using him as the example here and you will giggle. But I was like, let's say that Xavi Simons takes to the Premier League like a duck to water, and he is unbelievable. He's unbelievable. And he gets two goals or assists every game, and he leads Tottenham at the table. Do we go back and say, oh, everyone that played Tottenham before Xavi Simons was fit and ready to start got lucky? And my editor thought about it and said, yeah, I think so. Now, hasn't really happened for Simons, so don't worry about that example. But retrospective grading, which is effectively what, Jack, you're kind of hinting at there with Potter and what might transpire for West Ham for the rest of the season. It's on the agenda. It's on the table. I've done this first edition after 11 weeks of the season. I'm going to revisit it after about 22. And if we learn an awful lot and apply some context and I need to change a few things, that will happen. And just do you with regard to, like, you know, you sort of intimated that two things feel about level, but one feels like less powerful. I haven't produced like a spreadsheet where you can all look at it and go, well, team X are 7.5 points up. I haven't got a point system. I've tried to make it a little bit less scientific in terms of presenting it and just trying to tell people, like, well, actually, these are the luckier teams and these are the unluckier teams. I don't have a 1 to 20. It's not quantified in that fashion because genuinely, it's too difficult. One of the reasons is you've just mentioned it. How do you grade or value a new manager bounce misfortune versus an injury versus a confirmed VAR decision? It opens a whole can of worms. So I'm not going to turn around to you and give you a scoring system or a table. But what we can do is talk about which teams have benefited and which teams have not, and sort of talk about it in a more normal way, I guess.
Yeah, that seems completely fair enough. And I do appreciate the kind of subjectivity that comes into it. I mean, Florian Wirtz might be another one as well. If he starts to settle, you know, pre Florian Wirtz, Bundesliga probably Florian Wirtz levels and post could be a big factor in the season. Let's see. I mean, Liverpool fans will certainly be hoping so. Let's talk about injuries, because injuries have, I mean, for me, they are, aside from, you know, the massive overarching issues in the game, whether that's, you know, homophobia and racism, injuries are, for me, the worst bit of actual sort of in-game stuff that happens. I absolutely despise injuries. Everyone does. Your best player is going down injured. It's kind of unavoidable. It's unpredictable. You don't know when it's going to come. And they're just, it's just a nightmare for the players, let alone the fans. I mean, particularly for the players. But injuries have really dominated discourse in the last few seasons. The calendar's got busier and busier, particularly because I think Arsenal had a massive amount of injuries last year, but they also didn't have the depth to cope with the schedule. And they became a key talking point last year. This season too, who has been unlucky, lucky with injuries so far? And I imagine Arsenal probably feature on the unlucky side once again, but they've just got better depth to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, they are. They've been pretty unlucky here, Arsenal, I have to say. And it sounds like a really weird thing to say because they've been sat at the top of the table. And, you know, you're not going to get anyone crying for Arsenal about injuries when they've negotiated them so, so well. But they have had a few really difficult situations to deal with over the course of the season. And like it or not, like wherever they are on the table or not, and whether they won those games or not, they've had to overcome some odds. So, I mean, they played their first big game of the season at Anfield, you know, and that is, this is it. This is like the context I'm trying to apply here, because Liverpool win at Anfield and they didn't beat Manchester City a couple of weeks later at home. If they play these two games again later in the season and they don't beat Liverpool at home and they don't win at the Etihad, people will trot out the line, Arteta didn't beat these two teams in four attempts. They didn't win the big games against the title challengers. Of course, by that time, everyone will have forgotten that at Anfield, no Odegaard, no Saka, and Saliba limped off after 5 minutes. And they only lost to a Szoboszlai world-class free kick. Now, you can argue all you want about how attacking Arteta should be, but in a big game between two title challenges, you want your best players available, and Arsenal were without three of their best four? or maybe even outright three best players? Because Saliba is that good, or Declan Rice might have an argument with someone about that. Okay, let's just call it three of the top five. They didn't have them. This is unfortunate to have to go to Anfield and not have Saka and Odegaard and have Saliba limp after 5 minutes. This is the kind of thing that I'm trying to apply. And then they played City a few weeks later, and Saliba and Odegaard were missing, and Saka only played 45 or whatever it was. It was a combination of. I mean, look, not to discredit anything, Diggy, because you actually tried to tell me last week that you won this game. But you didn't. You drew it 2-2. But they went to Sunderland without any strikers.
You don't want to do that. I'll tell you that for free.
And it's not just no strikers. It's all three strikers are injured. We know that Gabriel Jesus is out. Kai Havertz is out. Victor Gyökeres is out. Marino is a fine stand-in. But if you employ three strikers and they're all injured, that's quite unlucky. Like, and Gyökeres never gets injured. So it's these kind of moments here where you're like, Arsenal have had to deal with a bit of a rough ride here. So it sort of makes what they've done look all the more impressive. Of course, there's another club here from London that have also had a rough ride, but not overcome it whatsoever. And that is Fulham. Jack, tough one for Fulham. Couple of games with no striker at all, like as in no strikers fit. Arsenal game it was, Joachim Andersen limps off. That means the entire first choice back four was not on the pitch, all
yeah,
injured.
Not ideal.
And no Sasha Lukic either. He was injured too. There have been some really rough games for Fulham in terms of either whole position groups being out or just a general malaise of injuries, which has generated a lot of sympathy from me.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can point to a couple in particular. Now, I don't know where context comes into this in a slightly different sense, in that I don't think we beat or get a point against Arsenal, no matter if the entire team is there, right? Like, I don't think the Fulham's level comes up enough where I think Arsenal had gears to go through. So that's where, you know, context is difficult to apply. I think you look maybe more at like something like the Villa game, obviously, where Raul Jimenez scores after 5 minutes or whatever it is, and then limps off, having injured himself in the process. Muniz is out, and Adama Traore plays the entire game through the middle as the number nine. That, for me, is the one that you look at and say, that's a period, and in the context of it, that's a period where Villa are going through their own little slide. And look, Fulham never win at Villa Park, as we've alluded to before.
It's in the rules.
It's in the rules. But also, if Fulham, you know, score that goal and Raul stays on, and, you know, then there's a kind of slightly different tinge to the first half in the way that it all plays out. Maybe Fulham take advantage of that situation more than they perhaps would against Arsenal at home. But I do agree with you. And I think that the strikers one feels like the thing that's being discussed within the Fulham fan base. It's, yeah. You know, Rodrigo Muniz now looks like he's out for 4 months on top of that. You know, Raul is in a situation where he had a bit of a resurgence and now is starting to look a little bit more like the rings in his legs are catching up with his actual age, if you will, to use an old Ranked FC trope. And Fulham do not have a third choice striker in which they trust, right? Jonah Kousinioris came
in. I've got a question there actually for you, because I'm not going to tell you how I feel about this, but one of my ESPN colleagues, Mark Ogden, said to me that, and it was on a podcast, I'm not just repeating private conversations, we were discussing the piece I'd done, and he said that he didn't necessarily agree with sympathy towards Fulham on the strikers, because he thought that the squad had been poorly planned, the transfer window was poor, not yeah. disagreeing with that, but they should have more strikers. And my riposte was basically, I don't think it's reasonable to expect Fulham to have three first team quality strikers on the books, because they play one up front, and they don't have European football, and they have a middling budget. I don't think teams in this Fulham situation can have three Premier League quality strikers. I think two is a totally reasonable number to have, and he just disagreed.
Yeah, and look, you can fall on both sides of that argument is probably what I would say. Mm. Like, Fulham, to get a third choice striker in, right, for a team of Fulham's caliber, and I'm sure that there are plenty of other teams in this same kind of situation, is a very difficult ask. Which player in a team that plays with one up front wants to be the third person up? You know, so you either have to get an absolute veteran who is happy with a very limited minute role, or you have someone who is a youngster who's yet to kind of make their mark, who has to try and accept it. And that's what Fulham did, right? They brought in Jonah Kousinioris. Now, whether you think that's a good idea or not, considering Marco Silva tends to like more senior players and doesn't give loads of opportunities to young guns, is up to you. But something we've discussed on Fulhamish before, last year, Fulham had a similar kind of issue where towards the end of the season, Rodrigo Muniz was out and Raul started, and Carlos Vinicius, who'd been putting out cones for the majority of the season, ended up coming on and playing the last 10, 15 minutes of games. Now, what happened off the back of that was Callum Osmond, who'd been scoring goals in the youth ranks, let his contract run down and went to Celtic in the summer, where he's made an impact off the bench before he got a really, you know, sad injury in recent games. But actually, if you'd given that opportunity to him at the end of last season, would Fulham have had a youngster that they might have been able to throw in this situation, who at least had a couple of reps as opposed to someone they bring in the summer? So I think it's a really difficult thing to put together. And I'm sure that, you know, there'll be plenty of clubs. If you do have European football, that's an easier ask because there's more rotations. But also, you know, certain position groups are always going to be a little bit weaker. Marco Silva is very much a manager who wants to have two players in every position, right? Like, that's pretty much his standard. And I'm not saying that's particularly outlandish or wild, but that's one of the things that, he's always talked about. And to have a third there, maybe you have to be a bit more aware of the situation in terms of the transfer window, where one of your strikers has had an injury towards the back of last season and another one is pushing 34 years old. You know, maybe you do have to be a little bit smarter in the way that you adapt your philosophy for that. But I can totally understand why Fulham haven't gone and spent an absolute ton on a third choice striker in that regard, unless it's someone who can play in different ways across the front line.
I do see both sides of the argument for sure, but I think I narrowly go down on Mark Ogden's side. I'm just thinking about the newly promoted sides, and it's potentially easier for them because everyone's delighted to be playing at Premier League level, particularly in Sunderland's case, you know, haven't been there for so long. But we do have Isidore, Mayenda and Brobby. I think of Leeds with Calvert-Lewin and Metcher and Okafor can play as a striker. Burnley have got Fleming and Foster and Broya when he's ever fit. I feel like a lot of clubs down at that bottom level, look at Forest's options. West Ham never really have anyone fit in that striking department. But
West Ham have zero strikers.
And also, Forest have European football, Doogie, so I think that's a slightly easier sell. But
yeah, no, I get what you mean.
Three strikers on the European
schedule.
Fulham
probably should have done was push the button on Tyreek George instead of bringing in Jonah Kousi-Assare, who doesn't look like he's, you know, within Marco Silva's plans at this point. Maybe that changes. But bring in Tyreek George there, who can play on either side and through the middle, and therefore your third choice striking option is someone who can also feature elsewhere. That's maybe the workaround, if I was kind of suggesting how I would probably do it if I was within the recruitment team. But equally, I appreciate that that's a far more expensive option than bringing in a kid on loan from Bayern Munich.
So Villa are in Europe and have two strikers. Yeah. So bucking the trend every sense of it. But you know, if they could have more than two, they would. But the financial squeeze becomes the financial squeeze with PSR. And Doogie, if you've been in the Premier League for a while and you're subject to these rules for a while, and you end up paying Premier League wages and Premier League transfer fees, and you still have to turn over the money, it actually does get harder to be able to justify those kind of wages. And a third striker on striker wages at a striker cost, like the striker's the most expensive position on the pitch, and so it. I can see exactly how Fulham ended up not addressing that. And I have sympathy for it. Now, this is when I talk about subjectivity in this index, this is kind of what I mean. Like, you and Mark can sit there and go, you're not as sympathetic Fulham as I am. That's fine. Yeah, that's why this is not some kind of science. I'm trying my best with it. To move us on, in terms of injuries still though, credit to Chelsea. So Chelsea is nuts. I mean, they've played most of the season without their best player, Cole Palmer. And so to have as many points as they do and to still just be ticking over is genuinely very impressive. They turned up to City Ground last month. They'd just come off the back of an international break and they're playing Forest and no Palmer, Enzo Fernandez injured, Moises Caicedo delayed travel back. Could only be on the bench. Can you ask for a better opportunity to beat Chelsea? That is such a fortuitous set of circumstances. They still lost 3-0. But that's not the point. I'm not working from a result backwards here. I'm saying, like, contextually speaking, when do you get these opportunities? And playing Chelsea in the first half without Caicedo, Enzo and Palmer, that's it. Like, no one else is going to get the opportunity. That's you're lucky to get that. And then bear in mind as well that by the end of their 2-1 win against Liverpool, the one where Estevao scored a 95th minute winner and Maresca went like hurtling down the sidelines. Did you see their defence at the end of that game?
Yeah, it was all over the shot, wasn't it?
Obviously, Colwell is injured. Fofana is injured. Tosin was injured. Chalobah was injured. Achampong limped off, as did Badiashile. They finished with Hatto and Reece James as centre-back. I mean, this is what I'm tracking here. Like, if you're churning points in these scenarios, fair play. And the last one I'll mention here is Spurs, because they have lost a couple of games recently, one to Chelsea, one to Aston Villa. Very notable that Christian Romero was missing in both. Romero is their most important player, I think. Their best ball progressor from the back and, you know, a good defender as well, a captain at the club. And if Spurs are missing Romero, they are a shadow of the team. And if you get to play Spurs without Romero, your chances of winning spike dramatically.
Plus Kulusevski and Maddison, right?
Plus Kulusevski and Maddison. Yeah, so I haven't necessarily factored those in because so like they knew like from there very early on in the summer that those guys were going to be out. Like, and so Xavi Simons comes in to take on the Maddison load. So there is a line to draw there too, which is how prepared are you for these scenarios? But if the window closes and you're all set and then all your right backs get injured, that's unlucky. If you go into the season with all your right backs injured and don't buy anyone, I have no sympathy.
Yeah, I think one, I totally agree with all those shouts. And every club, every fan that's watching this will call out something. You know, the fact that Youri Tielemans has only started 4 league games for Villa, that's unfortunate. Man City have had injury issues with Marmoush and Cherki and Itinori, and Rodri's obviously not been at full fitness either. A club that I'd actually probably give, not in terms of quantity of injuries, but just kind of contextually how important that injury was, Johan Visser getting injured as soon as he joined Newcastle to try and replace the impact of Alexander Isak. And Nick Voltermada's performances for club and country this season, absolutely amazing. I think given the pressure he's been under, especially with Karl-Heinz Rummenigge calling out that signing, etc., he was under immense pressure. But just because he's delivered doesn't mean that Newcastle haven't been handed a really difficult scenario by one of their two replacements not being able to make their debut yet. So there I am, giving some sympathy to Newcastle.
And I've got a mark in the spreadsheet here as well. Game week 10, Newcastle went to West Ham and they lost. They had no Livramento, no Lewis Hall, and no Kieran Trippier. Their fullbacks were Emil Kraft and Dan Byrne. That is worth a mark in my spreadsheet. Like, that's just, they've got no fullbacks, Doogie, you know? So again, adding that context, like, that was a disastrous result. To go to the London Stadium, to go 1-0 up and to go and lose 3-1 was like borderline embarrassing. But, and while no one really wants to hear it, except Newcastle fans, they had no fullbacks. Like, it's hard to play without any fullbacks. So this is what I'm trying to achieve.
Absolutely. Same goes kind of a little bit of sympathy towards Liverpool, given the fact that they signed a raft of new signings and players like Jeremy Frimpong, whether he'd be useful or the right fit for this system is up for debate, but he's barely got going. Do you have any sympathy for Liverpool with Alexander Isak? Probably not, because he threw his toys out the pram. He didn't do preseason training, etc. But that's still, you know, their big summer signing, along with Florian Wirtz, that hasn't really managed to get going due to injury as well.
So that's a double-sided conversation, really. In short, let's break the 11 games into two halves. First half of the season, second half of the season. First half of the season, Liverpool actually got really fortunate with injuries. And it happens to coincide with the fact that they won their first 5 games while everybody was saying, they're not very good. They played Bournemouth on the opening night and Bournemouth didn't have a fit midfield. Now, whether you want to factor in the fact that they changed their whole back line is up to you. I didn't, because half of those decisions were their choice. You know, they decided to sell Zabanyi. They decided to sell Kirkus. They weren't forced to do it. So a part of that reloading process was on them. But when they turned up with Marcus Tavernier in central midfield, I was like, wow, you really have run out of players. They just didn't have anyone fit. So Bournemouth, that was a nice time to catch Bournemouth on the opening night for sure. And they've had a couple of others of that ilk. You know, they managed to play Chelsea without Palmer.
Some people do call it Palmer FC.
They do. And they played Arsenal, of course, without Saka, Odegaard and Saliba. So in those first 5 fixtures where they racked up a lot of points, they got the rub of the green in terms of opponents' injuries. Then the cards started to fall a little bit out of their favour. And we all know that when Gravenberch isn't fit, they can't play properly. And we all know that even when he is playing, Alisson is still required to do a lot of bailing out. And those two have been injured. And so Liverpool's luck, I guess, has started to turn against them a little bit in that sense. So first half of the season, nice. Second half, not so nice.
Let's get on to the other categories as well in this index. And maybe we'll finish with the confirmed VAR errors and just get everyone really angry to finish. Let's go on to managerial changes, which is the kind of category that I put less importance to, but I'm intrigued about your findings in this category too.
Yeah, sure. So there have been 4 managerial changes. Well, at the time of writing, there have been 4 managerial changes. There's been a 5th, obviously. Wolves have decided to change their manager, and we don't know how that goes. It's going to be another wonderful test for the new manager bounce theory to see if Wolves can get some points in Rob Edwards' first game. But Forest are responsible for a couple of these.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, they decided to sack Nuno and replace him with Postecoglou. Typically speaking, and this is where I have a small crisis while writing the piece. I'm a big believer in the new manager bounce, but never have I seen a club voluntarily make themselves worse by switching managers. And they did it. And so, actually, Arsenal were quite lucky to face Forest first up, because everybody was just completely and utterly confused. And of course, Forest went to the Emirates and got slapped. Like, of course they did. It was a club in absolute disarray. So from that perspective, Arsenal got the rub of the green in terms of timings, because they were the first one up against crisis club Forest, all of their own making. And in Bournemouth, obviously, were the first ones up when Forest made the switch into Sean Dyche later. The definitely unlucky one here is a good one. It's the fact that Everton were first up against Nuno at West Ham. I know he hasn't necessarily pulled up too many trees, although he has obviously picked up two wins recently. But they drew that game. This was at Everton. This is probably a game that they're all looking at and thinking, we're going to win this. And then Potter went. And Nuno managed to eke out a point, which doesn't sound amazing, but it was their first point for a month. So it certainly had some kind of impact. So sympathies with Everton there for sure. And then, of course, we have Wolves coming up. We'll see what happens. I don't know. I'm not holding out too much hope. Just checking the fit. Home to Palace. I mean, it's tough, isn't it? It's really tough. We'll see. But that will be the fifth addition to the new manager bounce system.
Love it. The fifth addition to come this weekend. Okay, let's move on to the confirmed VAR errors, because I was reading through your article earlier and really enjoyed the whole thing, but I really enjoyed this section because so many of them I'd kind of not either forgotten about or not appreciated that there had been confirmation from the VAR and the refereeing officials that this was indeed an error. So who's been unlucky and lucky in these?
Yeah, so let's go back to the first weekend of the season. Liverpool are playing Bournemouth. Now, I've got unlucky as Liverpool here and Bournemouth down as lucky. You'll probably know that that game was won by Liverpool, so ultimately it didn't affect the result. But again, that's not really the point. We're just trying to contextualise things. Marco Senesi handballs the ball on the halfway line as Hugo Ekitike is about to run through on goal, and he is not sent off. That was wrong.
Yeah.
So Bournemouth should have been down to 10. And funnily enough, Marco Senesi has got away with this twice, because a couple of weeks ago, he should have been sent off for hacking down Ismail Assar when through on goal. Albeit he was going a little bit wide. Sars pretty quick, but the KMI panel decided that that was wrong and Senesi should have been sent off. Now in that game, Palace were two down at the time. They did come back to 3-3. It was a crazy game where Mateta racked up like 4 XG on his own and missed a huge chance to win it as well. But Palace were 2-0 down at that point. Now they came back to 3-3 against 11 men. Would they have won against 10? I mean, possibly. Mm-hmm. Possibly. That's an example of how these things really genuinely do matter. Jack, let's bring you back in again. It's been a lovely conversation with you. Fulham took the lead. I'm literally reading my own writing. Took the lead against local rivals Chelsea at Stamford Bridge in August.
This
thanks
is horrible.
To a wonderful goal from Josh King. I believe it was given goal of the month by Fulham.
We didn't score many others, to be fair.
Only for it to be incorrectly ruled out on VAR review for a foul in the build-up. Fulham went on to lose 2-0. So Fulham went 1-0 up at Stamford Bridge. It was incorrectly revoked and they lost 2-0. This is my point. It's a low-scoring sport. Like, it's hard to recover from these situations. Like, what it does to you in terms of, you know, how you only get 90 minutes to score enough goals. What does it do to you mentally? What does it do to you in the derby? This is horrendous. There's no two ways about it. This was just absolutely horrendous. And it's more sympathy for Fulham.
I mean, look, I tell you what was more horrendous. It was more horrendous being there. I'll give you that for free. But when you look at it, and again, like obviously the context of this is, do Fulham definitely go on and win that game? No. Like 100% not like a given. I thought we were the better side in the first half. And then obviously there's the second decision that goes against, which obviously isn't incorrect in terms of it wasn't decided, it was different, but you know, you get the kind of one decision goes against you, one decision goes against you again, but in the other end of the pitch. And it kind of all feels like it's spiraling. And for the last half an hour of that game, Fulham looked completely listless. Now, you can put that on Fulham and be like, you can't do that. You can't just lose your heads completely because a couple of decisions go against you. But, you know, the flip side of that is that, you know, from going from complete elation, your kind of boy wonder scoring his first Premier League goal in the derby away at Chelsea, a place that Fulham have, you know, very much struggled, apart from last season on Boxing Day, to get results down the years. Like, obviously, that's a sense of frustration. So we don't know how it impacts the game. There's a long way to go. And, you know, Chelsea go on and score two goals and ultimately win the game. And maybe it finishes 2-1. And we're not talking about a different result, but we can't contextualize those things, as you say. And I think that that's the element of it. If we're only working with what was deemed to be a wrong decision, I mean, look, I thought so. I'm sure loads of Chelsea fans will tell you that it's not, but that's the way it is. And ultimately, the decision has been deemed to be incorrect. You can't, you know, take that back and be like, oh, we'll split the points. You know, they don't keep you up on VAR decisions that were wrong against you at the end of the season, right? Like, yeah. That doesn't get you anything in the league table. So, yeah, obviously a frustrating element, and I don't want to sit here and go back through it all over again. But there is a sense that when games, you know, as you say, games change on goals like that, and Fulham had success, you know, in terms of the season before, going to the Bridge and eking out a result and finding moments as Chelsea had kind of sprung forward and the game then sort of got away from them. So, yeah, I mean, I can see where the sympathies have come our way in this regard anyway.
So I've written to the Premier League and I'm pleased to reveal this. At the end of the season, all the points will be tallied up. And then, like in Eurovision, when they add on the extra points at the end, there's going to be sympathy points added to each team's tally. And I'm going to give Fulham 150. You're going to win the league.
You're winning the league on sympathy points. You'll never sing that.
It's like the final day of the school year at Hogwarts, where it's just Gryffindor get an extra 200.
Yes. Incredible bravery showed by Neville Longbottom.
Exactly. Neville again, but this time at Jack and Fulham.
So there's a couple more. One that almost no one will remember. Wolves' Hugo Bueno was tripped in the box in the 71st minute against Everton. It should have been ruled a penalty. They were 3-1 down at the time. They went on to lose 3-2. So could they have got a point out of it? Possibly. We will never know. Do you remember when Nathan Collins pulled Brian Mbeumo back in the box by his neck and
yes,
didn't get sent off?
It was a joke.
That was very silly, and the KMI panel have agreed. What else have we got? Do you remember when Malagusto kicked Minter in the face at Stamford Bridge?
I don't remember this. I remember seeing this in your article. I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was a back post cross and Minter went to head it and Gusto went and did a high boot. And if he did make contact with his face, it was a very small amount. But I think we kind of know the rules about putting your foot in that general area.
Yeah, that sounds very Malagusto 25-26 as well.
It does, yeah. It's full on Malagusto. And nothing happened. Look, Chelsea ended up getting, a red card for a different reason. Well, that could be literally any game they play this year. And Brighton went on to win 3-1, I think it was. So it didn't really matter anyway. But still, a bit of a head scratcher. So it just goes in the list. So as I say, it's not results based. It's not outcome based. I'm not working backwards from results. I'm looking at what's happened and making those marks and adding that context. Not every bad decision leads to a loss. And that's not the point I've been trying to make all the way through. I'm just trying to track who gets the rub of the green and who doesn't. And over the course of 11 games, I've got a pretty good idea of who's been pretty fortunate so far and who's been very unfortunate. Over the next 11 games, dude, because that could change completely. You know, it could be like Fulham could get like 5 incorrect VAR decisions in their favour, and every team they play from now until January, all of their strikers get chicken pox somehow.
Chance to be a fine thing, Gary.
All of the strikers have been hanging out at parties and they all got chicken pox, and Fulham don't have to play any of them. Like, you never know what might happen. This doesn't doom anyone, and this doesn't cement anybody as lucky for the entire season. It's simply a checkpoint of 11 games. How has the season been shaped by fortune or misfortune so far? And I found it to be incredibly revealing. Like, I found it really interesting that Liverpool's 5-game win streak to start the season coincided with quite a lot of fortune with regards to opponents' injuries. Because it goes some way to explaining why they won despite playing like rubbish, because they were getting away with it. It adds a bit of context there. Fulham are being dragged into a relegation battle as it stands. Why is that? Well, they've been the unluckiest team in the league. Okay, if things even out a little bit, if things get a bit better, maybe they'll climb a few places and things will look okay. it just allows me to rationalize the table a bit more. Because as you know, Doogie, for the last 10 weeks, I've been telling you over and over again, the table's a liar. It's lying to me.
Yeah, you have said that a number of times, which I've had to say, no, Sam, because we're fourth and I like it. So I think it makes perfect sense.
Well, we're sixth and I love it because the XG table thinks we're rubbish. So
there was there was just one final sort of contentious call to mention, which hasn't been acknowledged as a VAR error. But I mean, it happened in the game before the international break in terms of the Premier League, where Van Dijk equalised against Man City and it was ruled out for offside. Because Andy Robertson was in the way of Donnarumma, or was he in the way of Donnarumma? That was the big debate. Howard Webb hasn't said that was a mistake. He said it was a not unreasonable decision to come to that decision. He basically kind of hinted in that kind of subjective grey area that it's not a big mistake because you can see why they came to that decision, but it's not a clear, yeah, they got that absolutely right as well.
Yeah, so we don't, as far as I know, we don't have a verdict on that because we're sat chatting on the 19th of November. And as far as I know, the KMI panel sit and they work in a 10-day arrears from the league. So this game happened on the 9th of November.
Yeah.
So set 10 days ago. So we'll probably get something in the next couple of days because they work in arrears. So maybe Howard Webb is right. Maybe. Can't believe I'm saying it. Maybe the chief of referees is right. Maybe. Or maybe the panel decide that the decision was wrong and that Howard Webb isn't speaking the truth. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
And it will be included in the next edition of this article, which will be seen in about 3 months' time. But it in terms of timing, it just didn't come through in time.
For sure. And I mean, I was going to sort of wrap up the podcast by firstly commending you on your excellent article and work. And in this podcast, you've really held it all together. And that spreadsheet, I'm sure it's an absolute beauty to look at. I love a spreadsheet. But to kind of give you a sort of 2 minute break or so, I kind of looked into the next few weeks and luck in the next couple of weeks. So who's currently got the most players out in terms of injuries? Spurs have 13 out, although 10 are expected back by the end of this month. 13 players out. Going from like knock to concussion. Well, I don't think anyone had concussion. Basically, a sliding scale of severity. But 10 are expected back by the end of the month. Chelsea, there's 8. We've already talked about them. That's Colwell for the season, of course. Palmer until December. Lavia, yeah, poor guy, just can't stay fit. Mudryk is obviously a sort of situation that no one knows when that's going to end. Newcastle currently have 8, but 7 of them, including Wissa, Byrne and Joe Linton, should be back by the end of the month. So their luck could change. And though I looked into who is facing these teams in the next few weeks, so who's potentially going to take advantage of that, those sides having a lot of injuries, and Arsenal play Spurs and Chelsea in the next couple of weeks. So whilst they've got this hellish week coming up where they play Spurs, Bayern, Chelsea, in terms of injuries, it's maybe not the worst time for Arsenal to play those sides. And then the teams that have the fewest amount of players out, Everton have only got 2 players out. That's Jarrod Branthwaite and Nathan Patterson. Patterson is expected back very, very soon. Leeds only have 2 players out. That's Willy Nonto and Sebastian Bournau as well, who's not really got going since his move in the summer. Man City, only 2. Rodri, who's expected back anytime soon, but he's come back and been subsequently injured a number of times already this season. Kovacic is out till March. So who are the sort of unlucky sides that I looked into facing these sides in the next few weeks? There's Man United in there. There's Newcastle are in there twice, though. Newcastle play Everton and they play Man City. So they are potentially have been quite unlucky in terms of their own injuries. But in the next couple of weeks, they are facing sides that have had, very few injuries, sorry. So they're coming up against them at the worst possible moment for Newcastle. So it could spell bad news for their sort of going into the festive period. And then they've got the derby against Sunderland as well, which I didn't manage to get tickets to, guys. I'm still gutted about it. So if anyone is listening to this podcast and has a spare ticket for the Stadium of Light on the 14th of December, please do let me know.
Anyone? Anyone? Hello?
Yeah, I'm expecting an immediate response to that.
What were you thinking there? Someone like just a random fourth voice is going to crop up and go,
yeah,
hey, Doogie.
I was just so sad about it. I was just reflecting on it. But yeah, no, I don't know why I paused there. But guys, that has been...
Hang on, I can offer you a ticket to Craven Cottage this weekend, but I can't offer you a ticket
for that,
to the top.
Actually, which is which I am looking forward to. But Craven Cottage away, oh, nice. Not quite the same as Newcastle at home. But I am looking forward to that. I'm going to Brighton away in December, but I just would have loved to do Newcastle at home as well.
So it's another truth derby.
Another truth derby this weekend.
Just quickly, clubs that don't have any marks for or against in my entire index. That, as in, I don't think there's been any, there's been no confirmed VAR errors, no essence of managerial bounces, and there's been no significant injury, fortune or misfortune swaying any of their games. I almost turned that into my customary guessing game, but that would be so boring because you'll never get them. So
I think Sunderland might be in there.
No, they're not in there. No. Mm. There's
Habib Diarra was maybe our big injury, I suppose.
No, it's not so just about that. It's about the basic of an injury as well. Nothing has swayed it. So you've definitely had some issues, but nothing to the point that is like so far has completely and utterly destroyed your team. Because even though you were telling me that Noah Siddiqui is out, he was like miraculously fine again.
That guy's made of granite. I don't know what's, he just doesn't stop.
Plays alongside granite anyway.
Yeah, this is true.
But anyway, the clubs are Leeds and Burnley. In my estimation, and there may be some of you out there that want to tell me that that's completely wrong, just Leeds and Burnley.
Leeds and Burnley.
Nothing there for in terms of injuries or anything like that. Maybe a Burnley fan will tell me, well, actually, we've got a very key player that has been missing, but I'm sure
a Leeds fan will say that your luck index doesn't include Gudmundsson deciding to head the ball into his own net in the 93rd minute at Craven Cottage. I imagine there's probably a level of that, but I mean, play stupid games with stupid prizes.
I'm afraid I cannot legislate for that. And just while we're at it as well, this will not factor into the luck index, and I hope you can both agree and ratify my decision. AFCON is coming. If you've got players that are going to AFCON, you knew about it from August, right? This is a decision you made. So this is not going into the luck index. Is that fair?
Absolutely. But I will mention it in December and January.
When half your squad's gone.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about it.
All your left backs are off, mate.
But it's not luck or bad luck. I completely agree with you.
It was a strategic decision.
We'll miss our spine of Iwobi and Bassey and Chukwueze, who will obviously all be over there. I mean, Sam, look, maybe you could look into this as a potential addition. How do players coming back from international breaks with absolute heartache from not qualifying for a World Cup affect the next performance that the team comes into? Look, I'm just saying.
Dr. Ty, MD, will be checking everybody's hearts to... look, in Liverpool's case, maybe AFCON could be a good thing because they've tried playing Salah into form. It hasn't worked. They tried benching him. It hasn't worked. Maybe if he goes and stars at AFCON and comes back, he could find form for the first time this season.
This is true.
It could be a good thing.
Thinking of Dr. Ty, I could always sling an email to the woman that I accidentally email quite often, Sue Ty, and see what Sue Ty makes of that.
Is she a doctor?
I don't know. She's a doctor in my mind. She doesn't like my emails either way.
God, the listeners don't know what you're on about. Doogie asked him for my email once, and despite the fact that I spelled it out three times in very specific letters and Jack heard it all, he got it wrong. I did. And he emails a woman named Sue.
Sue Ty.
Instead of me.
Yeah. I'm on a sort of banned list from Sue, I imagine now. But it hasn't happened for quite a while. But guys... that was the truth for another week. And I think you should all, in the comments on YouTube, and write loads of thank you messages to Sam, because that was really the Sam show after his brilliant work for ESPN. And I thoroughly enjoyed chatting through his article today. You guys can listen and find out whether you are unlucky, lucky, or whatever. Get in the comments. Message us online as well. Are you happy, unhappy with how your luck has been going so far this season? Does it really exist? All that good stuff. Massive, massive thank you to Jack for running the ship as ever.
You're very, very welcome, Doogie. And Sam, I found that very, very therapeutic. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah, that was great from a Fulham perspective. Sam, you can very much put your feet up this evening.
I will. I've had a tough week and, a busy week. And I'm looking forward to relaxing a little bit. And for the first time in like 3 weeks, playing my PlayStation. Good.
Nice.
International breaks used to be
Bailey's
really quiet
chocolate
for me.
Orange.
Yeah, I will. 100% will, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
He put that in our WhatsApp group earlier. He's found it in the back of the cupboard. He's in for a wild Wednesday night.
Found it in the back of the cupboard. I found it in Sainsbury's earlier. Other supermarkets are available.
Okay, nice, nice. Well, enjoy your Baileys, guys. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for watching. And we'll catch you next week. Bye-bye.